So Renew, big day today. Big paper you just got published big in European day. Urology.
Yes, it's very exciting. You know, it's been probably about a year of work in progress, but super excited to have Lutectomy finally published.
Yeah, so I'm afraid this is somewhat self-indulgent, this episode of GUcast, because the team who are behind GUcast have been, well, we do a lot of research, as many of you know, but one of our favorite trials has just been published in European Urology this week. It's called the Lutectomy Trial. So today we're going to talk all about lutectomy, and we've brought in our nuclear medicine physician extraordinaire and co-PI on the trial, Professor Michael Hoffman from Peter Mac. Michael, good to have you back in the studio.
Thanks, Declan. It's
great to have you back. Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny to think that the first podcast we had featured Michael and the pro-PSMA trial.
That's right.
So it's kind of nice to have you back on for lutectomy.
Yeah.
I was telling this story the other day about COVID breaking out and EAU plenary was going to be pro-PSMA, and then the flights got cancelled literally days before. And somehow we did it in podcast format instead.
It was such a weird time, wasn't it? That literally the country had just closed down and we were excited you were coming to EAU and you're going to stand up and read out pro-PSMA and it was going to be published in The Lancet same day and all that. But it got published in The Lancet the same day. But instead of being in front of a big audience in some flash European city, we were hiding in a small room at Peter Mac trying to figure out how to do a podcast. But there you go. We somehow got there. So we're celebrating the lutectomy trial, which has been published this week. It's a very interesting piece of work. And, you know, a really, really, really great multidisciplinary team put this together. And so forgive us if we indulge a bit. But I know a lot of the audience for GUcast are very, very interested in PSMA imaging, PSMA theranostics. So this podcast today will allow you to indulge in the lutectomy trial as well.
Because face it, we're all really nuclear medicine physicians at heart, right?
Exactly.
You especially, Declan.
Michael, what do you call the specialty?
You're both nuclear urologists. There's no question about it. You're nuclear urologists.
Nuclear urologists. So, and to celebrate, we have a great guest on the podcast, a friend of the podcast, Professor Ken Herman, nuclear medicine physician from Essen, is joining us as well. But you're not in Essen today. Where are you, Ken?
I'm in San Diego, enjoying the nice weather of Southern California.
Of course,
congratulations to you for this fantastic paper being published. I think there was a great presentation at EAU 23 by Renew.
Yeah.
But now having this really in print, I think is something very special.
Yeah, and Ken has written, and colleagues, Boris Hadashek and others have written a very nice editorial in European Urology as well about this. So we're really interested in your thoughts because you've looked at this study, well, as it developed and as it read out now, Ken. So we're very grateful to you for joining us. We thought we'd start Renew by going back and talking to Michael, as myself are the co-PIs on the study, about how this study came about. And I suppose I'll kick off, Michael, by saying that this area of high risk or unfavorable intermediate risk prostate cancer is still an area of unmet need because many of these patients, unfortunately, will relapse. So 30, 40, up to 50% of patients undergoing surgery or radiotherapy for high-risk localized prostate cancer will eventually relapse. So we're neoadjuvant trials, as this is, treatments before surgery, remain an area of intense interest because there is no standard of care. There is no standard of care neoadjuvant approach for high-risk prostate cancer. All the other strategies have shown some benefits or no benefits, but there is no standard of care. So this space is important for patients to see, can we improve outcomes? Can we reduce failure rates for patients then having treatment?
Which is really important because, you know, in many other cancers, we do have standard of care neoadjuvant treatments. And so prostate cancer is unique in that way.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, you're going to treat and expect failure in a significant number of patients. And look, the rescue strategies are very good. That's often the way we speak to patients about it. But nonetheless, I suppose over to Michael, because over the past few years, of course, we've had very exciting other options coming into very advanced prostate cancer, which has led to coming full circle like this. So yeah, maybe you'll take us back to, when was it, 2019 or 2020, when we were starting to come up with this this trial?
Did it start in an Irish bar?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember the genesis. Look, I think we were seeing amazing results in end-stage disease. We had published our phase 2 Peter Mac trial, 30-patient, 50-patient trial in Lancet Oncology, and the therapy trial was still underway, comparing lutetium PSMA-617 to cabazitaxel, but going well. And then Movember in Australia put out a grant call for, you know, something big, because it was a $4 million grant call and it needed some fund matches as well to take it up to sort of more like a $6 million grant. and they were going to award two or three Australia-wide. So we had to put in a Peter Mac proposal, and that brought out lots of people at Peter Mac. I've got this idea, I've got this idea, I want to do this. So I think we needed to get you, Declan, involved to mediate all of us and and decide, well, what should we pitch to Movember? Should we pitch, you know, some immunotherapy trial, or should we pitch something related to PSMA, or should it be something more translational? There were lots of options because there is a lot of great research happening at Peter Mac in so many different domains. But I think we had a crazy idea to take lutetium PSMA from a last line and just push it all the way forward to a first line prior to surgery or prior to radiotherapy as an initial treatment option. And clearly we weren't going to deny patients a curative intent option such as surgery or radiotherapy. So we said, let's do it in addition to. So we came up with this initial trial design, which had a bit of a radiation oncology cohort and a surgical cohort where we're going to do 10 prior to surgery, 10 prior to external beam. And that was only half the project because the other half is upfront PSMA, which was a trial in newly diagnosed advanced metastatic prostate cancer. And we thought if we put both of those together into one grant, really the message being from last line to first line, that this may be a compelling proposition to fund.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. And I remember those early days speaking to you about that, and other neoadjuvant trials were up and running. We, you know, we had neoadjuvant ADT trials many years ago, and then in more recent years, ADT combined with AR pathway inhibitors and chemotherapy and all sorts. So we were still very interested in the space. But one of the first questions, Michael, was because lutetium PSMA is usually given with ADT, and because almost every ADT neoadjuvant prostatectomy trial has had ADT, that was the first question. And can you bring us to the journey of why did we decide to go for straight lutetium? Because that's not something that we'd ever done before.
Yeah, look, I think we already saw that when you start a patient on ADT, you see a response very quickly on PSMA PET. Your intensity goes down, and this is a theranostic treatment. We can see what we treat, and we want to get highest dose delivery. And we thought if we pre-dose with ADT, it might compromise what we do. And we're also selecting a group of patients where ADT is not used as a standard of care. You just do a prostatectomy on its own and cure a good proportion of these patients. So we didn't want to add side effects and burden to this treatment.
Very good. So Ken, we'll go over to you to ask you your thoughts on that at this stage, because of course in Germany is where all the initial experience of radioligand therapy with lutetium PSMA came from, your colleagues in Heidelberg and you with a very big program in Essen. So, you know, back at that stage 4 years ago, did you think that we'd be trying to move this therapy forward in a research setting?
So I think this concept is absolutely intriguing because if you're really honest, it's, I think, the first trial, neoadjuvant trial of a lutetium medicine therapy. I mean, we have a lot of experience with thyroid cancer. There's no neoadjuvant therapy available or concept available. We have done PRT. There's a couple of patients, I think, in the Netherlands who had PRT in the neoadjuvant setting, not a real clinical trial. So I think it's the first time that someone really tried to bring this prior to surgery. I think this is one of the reasons why we found this super intriguing. You're well aware that we used you as an inspiration, trying to even build something which potentially is following your pathway. But I think the concept to really try to understand, can we potentially really, first of all, maybe even reach complete pathological responses? And the second thing is, or can we reduce the likelihood that there's a certain recurrence most of the times outside of the prostate bed? And that's why I think the concept, and which was published, I think, in 2021, the trial concept was absolutely intriguing for the whole field.
Yeah, and Michael, before we go into the details of the study design, I remember very vividly sitting with yourself and the late John Violet, our radiation oncology colleague, as there was a critical meeting where we had to nut this out and figure out what is the selection criteria going to be based on PSMA PET, you know. On the one extreme, I was thinking, as long as there's some PSMA avidity, like in the VISION trial, sort of, that'll be a reasonable target. On the other hand, I remember you and John pushing very hard to say, we need a super target, because it was at that meeting where you decided dosimetry needed to be the endpoint. Do you want to talk us through how we got that? And maybe the listeners will then figure out that, okay, dosimetry and SUV max is a very interesting academic idea for us.
Well, I think it was challenging to pick the primary endpoint of the study. You know, what's going to be the primary endpoint? Because it was the first time, it's going to be a small trial. We're not going to look for long-term outcomes in 10 or 20 patients. That's going to need a much bigger trial. Clearly, safety is an endpoint, and we can do some measures of activity, such as PSA drop or even imaging response. But we thought, why not make dosimetry the primary endpoint? Because if we can show that you can get 50 gray, 100 gray to the prostate cancer primary with a single intravenous injection, that's pretty compelling. And that's essentially how external beam works. And we know we can cure patients with external beam radiation. So it ought to stand that if we can get high doses, then in the future, you know, this may be a very good treatment, either in combination or maybe even alone. And then we wanted to enrich it for patients that are really, really likely to benefit. And already in Australia, everyone has a PSMA PET CT prior to a radical prostatectomy and high-risk prostate cancer. It's a standard of care. So it doesn't need to be a study procedure. You're doing these every day. Why not just pick the patients with really high uptake and put them on this trial?
And I remember that then we were literally looking at, okay, what number is a, is an SUV max of 10 reasonable? And as John and Michael were saying, no, the SUV max needs to be like 20, 30, 40. I was thinking our experience from PRO-PSMA was, well, of course, the pool is narrowing down. And lots of men we learned from PRO-PSMA have high-risk prostate cancer, they even have metastases. But the SUV max may not be above 20. But yeah, so it was kind of a negotiation, I remember, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think what I did at that point was I pulled out the PRO-PSMA data set because it was these patients and we'd imaged 300 of them on the trial. And I just did a waterfall quick plot of the SUV maxes. And we decided, or it was evident that around only, I think 30, 40% of PRO-PSMA had that SUV. But we figured, you know, that's enough. We're only after 10, 20 patients. Another secret of this trial is that we, you know, just the way we put these grants together, we love collaboration and we love Google Docs because we can all sit on a document and play around with the protocol as we're editing it. So, you know, I think Declan, myself, John Violet, you know, Arun, others, we're all busily editing this this Google Doc, but then we ran into a little bit of a hiccup, I remember.
I remember that.
What was the hiccup?
Because there was a grant deadline. This Movember grant, Movember, our main sponsor on this, was coming up, but we both ended up in Shanghai at a meeting. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, yeah. We went to the GU oncology meeting in Shanghai that I think we're both going to this year as well.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Fudan University, that's right.
And when we entered China, suddenly our Google Doc stopped working.
That was it. Yeah. So I remember we ended up sitting beside each other in the lobby of a hotel, kind of just saying, "Can you show me yours? Show me yours." Blah, blah, blah. That's how it got finished. Yeah. So that, I suppose, takes us up to the study, Renu. So for those who haven't read it yet, we'll put links down below. But yeah. Do you want to talk us through? Then we'd agreed, okay, it's going to be high risk prostate cancer and or unfavorable intermediate risk. SUV max 20, but do you want to talk us through the study design and the results because you're the first author on this?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a unique study. I mean, although this was the first study that used lutetium PSMA 617, it's not the first study of neoadjuvant lutetium PSMA. The other study that used INT, which is not quite FDA approved yet, you know, was published in European Urology Oncology.
The Israeli group.
That's right. Yeah. But I think what's unique to this study is that the endpoint, which is dosimetry. So really trying to figure out how much you know, targeted radiation, can you really get to tumours expressing PSMA? And then surgical safety, which is something that as a neoadjuvant study, you know, all surgeons are worried about operating after someone who's potentially had radiotherapy to the prostate. So so we recruited 20 patients, you know, in a staggered fashion. So the first cohort of 10 patients had one cycle of lutetium PSMA and the second cohort of 10 patients had two cycles once we confirmed safety. And then the two cycles were spaced 6 weeks apart, and then all patients underwent a robotic prostatectomy with or without a lymph node dissection 6 weeks after the final cycle of lutetium PSMA. So that was really the study design. And, you know, we've already touched on the inclusion criteria, the most important one being that all patients had an SUV max of greater than 20 in either the primary prostate or the regional pelvic lymph node. So they could have N1 disease, but not further than that. And so, you know, if we're talking about results, the primary endpoint, of course, is dosimetry. So how much radiation are we getting into the tissues? And if we looked at all the tissues that expressed PSMA, the median radiation dose was about 35.6 gray. Interestingly, the prostate had a median dose of about 19.6 gray, and the lymph nodes higher, 37.9 gray, so almost 38 gray to the lymph node. So that was the first interesting find from the study. So, you know, reasonable amounts of targeted radiation to the tissues. And I think one of the most impressive things with that is, despite that level of radiation, surgery was very safe after lutetium PSMA. You know, we were pleasantly surprised that all the tissue planes were really quite well preserved. There was not that usual level of extensive fibrosis that you can sometimes see after external beam radiotherapy. You know, the surgical difficulty was graded in a fairly subjective manner, but I think we only had a handful of patients that we said was slightly more difficult than normal, keeping in mind that these are all high-risk prostate cancers and they're all difficult surgeries to begin with.
And lots of them node positive as well. And we did show some of those videos during the EAU, and I operated on most of these patients, I think. And so you're having big lymph nodes getting a big dose of radiation. And because we have a lot of experience with salvage prostatectomy, but that's traditionally 3, 4, 5 years after external beam or brachy or after HIFU or cryo. And it's usually horrific for due to the fibrosis. So I would say I was a little bit nervous thinking, okay, it's only a 6 week period or 12 week period, but they were getting big doses into the lymph nodes. And yeah, they peeled off really nicely.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's important, isn't it? Because if we did find that, oh my God, these lymph nodes or the prostate is all welded or it's falling to pieces and the anastomosis is going to be difficult, then there'd be real questions about it as a strategy, because it would be, you know, adding morbidity to an operation that already has morbidity. But that was very reassuring.
And very well tolerated systemically, you know, no grade 3 or 4 adverse events. And the post-operative care was very routine. So again, you know, most patients were discharged on day one, like we would normally do. And there were not really any post-operative complications that were attributed to lutetium PSMA. So from a surgical standpoint, it was very reassuring.
And Michael, a couple of the other endpoints in it before we ask Ken for his thoughts were, we did repeat the PSMA PET CT just prior to surgery. So that was either 6 weeks after lutetium first cycle or 6 weeks after second cycle. And we did see some, but it was variable, but we saw some really amazing responses.
Some pretty amazing responses. So some patients with, you know, 3-4 centimeter lymph nodes really shrunk down by, you know, way more than 80%. Some lymph nodes disappeared completely. So we definitely saw some pretty impressive responses, but they were variable. And I think, you know, small numbers, but I think it did correlate with maybe the aggressiveness of the tumor. Tumors that are growing quickly tend to shrink more quickly after radiation, and also the intensity of uptake. But we were mindful that 6 weeks is not enough, but we didn't want to compromise patient care. That's why 6 weeks is in there. But after a dose of radiation, the effects go on for many, many months. So after external beam to the pelvis, you can see PSA declining for as much as 12 to 18 months afterwards. So in an ideal world, I would have liked to have waited at least 3 months after a dose of lutetium to see its maximal response. But we didn't want to compromise safety. And I guess, you know, we wanted, you know, it's interesting that you even let us do this trial, just to change tacks for a second. Because I remember at some point I was presenting this trial concept overseas at a meeting, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, how did your surgeons agree to do this? In my country, they would have shut you down. So I don't know why. I think surgeons are a bit scared of radiation, or they don't like radiation. But you embraced this trial.
Yeah, look, let's go and talk to Ken now. But like Ken, we work in a very collaborative environment, and that's what's led to some really good research questions and patients being looked after very well. But because it's an unmet need, Renew, I suppose that was the thing. And because we had such big experience in our centre using lutetium very safely, it seemed like an obvious thing to do. But we wanted to be very rigid about it in a very, you know, robust trial with very tight control on the data we're gathering to make sure that patients were safe and that we could at least inform future questions, I suppose.
And, we can treat aggressive prostate cancer very well with surgery. Yeah. So, you know, it's always it's a nervous time to have that wait. But I think in the way that we recruited to the trial, you know, that first cohort of 10 patients having one cycle, making sure that they were safe, making sure that surgery was safe, it gave us a lot of confidence then to recruit that second cohort of patients.
Now, neoadjuvant trials also measure other important endpoints like PSA response and particularly pathological response, what's happening in the prostate. So can you tell us a little bit about those secondary endpoints?
Yeah, so I mean, oncological endpoints weren't really the main aim of this trial, but we did see some form of histological response in most patients. One patient, in fact, had minimal residual disease. The median PSA reduction rate was 45%, and about 49% of patients had a PSA reduction of 50% or more. And after a median follow-up of 13.8 months, the biochemical recurrence-free survival was 80%. So, you know, there's encouraging results there, but it's, you know, it's too short a follow-up for a, for an oncological endpoint.
And I remember having conversations with two of those patients prior to surgery whose PSAs had come down, and you guys are showing them the PET scans showing the cancer has almost completely disappeared. Going, do I still need a prostatectomy? I'm just can I have more loose tissue? And so it's always part of the equipoise, isn't it? And speaking to people. So Ken, let's go and talk to Ken. So we've just dived through a bunch of the results. Ken, you're very familiar with the paper. I think you're a reviewer. You've written the editorial. So yeah, what's your response? You can temper our enthusiasm, by the way. Feel free.
No, I think there are a couple of points which are quite interesting and I want to highlight. So first of all, Renu also mentioned the dose, right? So in the lymph nodes, the dose was almost double as high as in the prostate, yeah. Something which I would not have predicted, to be honest. And I would like to also hear your thoughts about this. The second thing I think is very interesting, we mentioned already the study from Tel Aviv in Israel, where they used PSMA-INT. And I think in contrast to your protocol, they applied 2 to 3 doses. They gave a higher activity of 7.4 gigabecquerel. And the interval was actually only 2 weeks compared to 6 weeks, what you did. Nevertheless, when you look at the PSA 50 decreases, they were not as impressive as what you reported. And I would like to, I mean, first of all, for me, the big message is two different compounds, which seem to be not so different after all, are both well tolerated, independent on how much activity was given and also independent how long the time interval was. This is good for us. It reassures us also for the future. But I would like to discuss with you and also understand your thoughts a little bit. First of all, how did you choose the 5 gigabecquerel? What, for example, do you think is the reason that we have a higher dose in the lymph node, which is actually quite nice when we think about what is our main goal in the follow-up of these patients? And then the third one, what is the reason that even so that you gave less and longer time differences, you saw a significant, more impressive PSA response compared to the lutetium PSMA-INT study. Of course, I have my own thoughts, but I would like to hear you guys first.
Michael, maybe we'll ask you about the dose.
The dose. Look, I think at that time there was not a well-established dose. I think when we designed this trial, neither Vision nor Therapy had read out. We were mindful about really a group of patients that may be cured and may be alive in 10, 20 years' time, and secondary risks of even myelodysplasia. And so we really wanted to just err on the side of safety. And as we work this up in our institution, it's clear that our ethics committee is quite risk-averse, appropriately. We really want to ensure patient safety. And we have this principle called the sink effect that we believe quite strongly in, which is that when you've got a larger tumour burden, you need a larger administered amount of radioactivity. And the patients we're treating to date have extensive metastatic disease. So as we go to these patients with just probably volumes of disease that are 1/20th, maybe even 1/50th of the metastatic population, that we can probably lower the dose a little bit as well. So it was rather empiric, but we settled on 5 gigabecquerels and 6 weekly timely was just based on the evidence to date from Therapy and Vision. We went with a standardised cycling.
And I think that's important because, I mean, no one really has long-term safety data with lutetium PSMA, and these are patients that potentially will live for many, many years. So you really can't compare it to the metastatic population. So I think, it, you know, for a phase 1/2 trial, we were really focusing on safety of the treatment. It was important to be conservative.
And Michael, you mentioned earlier on that ideally you would have waited longer. So can you please explain that to us, how radioligand therapy works? As you say, we had to get the balance right without waiting too long. These men were in a curative intent pathway. But radioligand therapy, you don't expect to see its maximal response at 6 weeks or 12 weeks. Is that what you're indicating?
Yeah, correct. So the mechanism of action is essentially similar to external beam radiation. So we deliver high doses of radiation to tumour DNA. We get some double-stranded DNA, some single-stranded DNA. And what tends to happen is some of that DNA damage doesn't actually result in instant cell death or apoptosis or senescence or whatever the mechanism is, but it just sort of stuns the cell. And then when it undergoes mitosis, it's damaged enough that it cannot divide. Mm-hmm. And at that time point, cell death occurs. This has been well shown in sort of external beam models many, many years ago. And what that means is when you look at tumor kinetics after radiation, it often shrinks at a similar rate to which it grew. So if we've got a rapidly growing prostate cancer or neuroendocrine tumor, or thyroid cancer, and we treat it with radionuclide therapy, it shrinks very quickly. But some of these tumors grow quite slowly, and certainly some prostate cancers do. If you did a Ki-67 on the histopathology to get a measure of the mitotic rate, you probably get a measure of this. And so if you can kind of just do a thought experiment on that, if your tumor is growing slowly, it's going to shrink slowly after a lethal dose of radiation.
So, Renu, what are the conclusions of the study?
Yes, I mean, the main message we took home was that it was safe prior to surgery. It was well tolerated, and there were some promising results, you know, encouraging results seen from a pathological, biochemical, and imaging point of view. And it gives us the confidence to now fashion the new trials that will help us to see if lutetium PSMA is a viable upfront treatment option.
So, Ken, that's what we want to spend the last few minutes talking about, is where to next for radioligand therapy. Because I suppose between this study and the Israeli study, the question was, well, is there any point pursuing this? And I think many people have concluded, yep, there seem to be some signals here. And in your editorial, you talk about a few of the ongoing trials. So can you give us your thoughts on where to from here?
So, of course, I have the Essen bias. So what we're trying to work on is actually to do the same trial you did, but we tried to actually use two cycles of lutetium 7.4 gigabecquerel and add immunotherapy to this. And this is a so-called NEPI trial. We have all the paperwork in place, and we hope that the first patient will be still recruited in 2023. This is one thing. The second thing is it's a dream of myself, is that we always administer the therapy so far intravenously. And of course, we have quite some good experience from radioembolization in liver cancer to actually administer certain therapies intraarterial. So the second trial, which is a lupus trial, is actually going to investigate the application of intraarterial lutetium PSMA, including a prostate embolization. These are two trials we're working on, trying to understand, very similar to the Peter Mac group, which is a role model for us, as it only works if you have a surgeon who's open enough to do this and to really try to understand what we can really do to improve patient care. And I think it's exciting times. I mean, one of the dreams is really to move this very potent therapy into earlier lines. And obviously, neoadjuvant treatment would be like the holy grail almost of earlier line therapy.
It's a challenging time ahead, isn't it? Because when we are going to design, Michael, the phase 3 trial, you know, again, the challenges of what are the endpoints of this trial going to be, you know, what dose is effective, how many cycles is effective, how long do we wait after treatment before surgery, do we need surgery at all, you know, what those sorts of questions are really, really challenging. So where do we go from here?
I mean, there's lots of different options, and I just hope the European Urology publication really just inspires a lot of people to do different versions of where to take this. What I would do is, you know, I think it really is a promising combination in highly selected patients, not everyone. Mm-hmm. I think you do need to select patients carefully. You know, I think if you have surgery, you have a significant, not an insignificant failure rate. In the order of 40% in this very high-risk population. So I'd like to see if we can reduce that in combination with surgery. So really do a large randomized version of lutectomy. We can probably, you know, we don't care too much about dosimetry in a big randomized trial. We just want to give the radiation. We can debate how many cycles, then do surgery. And in the other arm, in a randomized design, just do surgery alone with an endpoint of, you know, biochemical failure at whenever, 2 years, 5 years. I think that would be a extremely neat trial design, and I really do think that we would increase the number of patients that are cured. We still won't cure everyone, but we'll increase the number of patients that are cured, and not too many radioligand therapies are aiming at cure. So this is a really neat strategy. And you could take the same approach with external beam as well. So rather than combining with surgery, if you're keen on external beam, you could add it in combination with external beam radiation as well. That's what I would do.
I think one of the interesting things, Declan, is that even though we selected patients based on PSMA expression, we found that actually this is in fact still a very heterogeneous group. And one of the most valuable things the Lutectomy trial has helped us do is do some great translational work, because we have that pre-treatment biopsy tissue, we have the post-treatment prostatectomy tissue, which is a unique opportunity to study what happens to the tumour microenvironment and how it responds to this sort of radioligand therapy. And we've got some important work undergoing at the moment, a lot of it which is funded by the PCF. It'll be really interesting to see if we can better select which patients would be appropriate for this treatment and also for various combination therapies.
Yeah, just a shout out to you, Renu, because Renu's doing a PhD focused on these translational endpoints, PCF Young Investigator. Yeah. We're heading off to the PCF retreat in a few days' time.
Yeah.
So kudos to you. You know, there aren't too many surgeons, at least in Australia that I know, in any surgical domain who are heading back or into the laboratory to do some hardcore translational work. So I think this is
it's fantastic for the PCF to support our work like this. And, you know, you mentioned the word cure, and I think cure from prostate cancer and ending of suffering from prostate cancer is really their big vision. And I think it's exciting times ahead.
And some of the other ongoing trials, you mentioned radiation, Michael, but I remember visiting NKI in Amsterdam last year. And Wouter and team there already are on a dose escalation study doing neoadjuvant lutetium prior to radiation, so that's ongoing. Brian Chapin and co at MD Anderson
have the NALIPROST.
A neoadjuvant trial using the hybrid tracer, I think, and a few ADT, others ongoing, ADT.
Yeah, and I think a strategy you could do there is decrease the dose of external beam and use the lutetium PSMA really as a boost to really minimise side effects, you know, even if it was equivalent to external beam, but you could really lower the dose so that you don't get as much or any side effects. Yeah. This could be a really useful strategy. And maybe it's worth going back to the beginning again, because this when this started, we were working very closely with John Violet, one of our radiation oncologists, who sadly passed away during the course of the study. But he actually did the opening speech at the SIV, the site initiation visit. Declan, do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I remember that very well. It's hard not to get emotional about it. John was a great colleague of ours, passed away during COVID, but the SIV, the whole thing was during COVID. It was amazing how we recruited that trial here in Melbourne, where we were really severely locked down. Yeah, John did a very inspirational speech, and we actually have the video of it. You know, I might, maybe we'll stick it on at the end of this podcast, actually, if you want to stay on and listen. We have from a very gifted clinician scientist, the great late John Violet, but it was a great talk, wasn't it? And we've obviously acknowledged John in the paper as well. So it's a lot. This was his drive and his vision. Yeah. Actually, you mentioned at the start we intended this to be a neoadjuvant study using radiation. So by the way, the follow-on from that was in the grant review process. Maybe Ken will comment on this. You weren't involved in that. But when we were applying for the grant, the international review panel asked us to take out radiation. They just liked the clean design of surgery because we could get the endpoints very cleanly. We could get tissue and so on. So our intent was certainly to explore this in the radiation group, but we didn't actually get to do that. So what are your thoughts on it? Michael just mentioned it as well, how we might embrace this in a radiation population. Have you been thinking about that, or any other investigators in Germany doing that?
I think what Michael said, the comments are very valid, that it's a good thought to combine this and potentially adapt or reduce the way we use external beam. I think the reason we also focus currently on surgery only in our trials is because we really want to have this tissue and call it this tissue and better understand what's really happening, what is the lutetium therapy together with the immunotherapy really doing to the tissue. But in the long run, I fully echo what Michael said. We need to be open in combination for actually both measurements, not only surgery, but also for external beam.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's exciting times, isn't it? I'm excited and I'm to see this paper published, and it was really interesting to do it. I was asked soon after the paper got accepted, Michael, why it was called Lutectomy. Do you want to tell us that story? Because it's a provocative title, as the urologists out there might notice. Why are we calling something Lutectomy? It seems a bit of a threat. It's Michael Hoffman named this trial, by the way.
Look, I think it was before the days of ChatGPT, so we couldn't just say, can you come up with an acronym for the trial? And I like trial names where you look at the trial name and you know something about what it is. So lutectomy, it sounds a bit like an operation. It's got the ectomy bit. It's a bit surgical. It's got the loo from the lutetium. It merges together. It just sort of rolls off the tongue. We're gonna do a lutectomy.
Yes, instead of a prostatectomy is what he was going to say. You know, right. This is a direct challenge. And I remember standing up at the EAU around the time this was being developed, and I was asked to do a debate on focal therapy. And I was thinking to myself, you know, this injected radiation, liquid radiation, as I think you call it, could be the ultimate focal therapy, couldn't it? Imagine if you just got a big avid tumor and you inject radiation, it doesn't really get anywhere else, but it goes into the tumor. Instead of us sticking needles in and doing HIFU and cryo and nano knife and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, there's that idea as well. You know, if and then I think you'd go back to the start and really want to do dosimetry and mapping and give a whopping high dose and give it every 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, I still think that's an interesting idea, focal radioligand therapy.
Do deep dive into the supplementary appendix, because we do have quite a lot of detail in there, including some patient images. And these dosimetry images are extraordinary, because we give a single injection into a vein. And when we do a whole body image, there's really uptake at day 96 hours, sort of day 3, that's just localized to the prostate cancer. The kidney salivary glands is all washed out by then, largely. So you get this extraordinary uptake just in the prostate gland. There are a few sort of isotopes that we can use that are just so specific. So just extraordinary images. And
we do have some of those images in the paper as sort of like a case study with that remarkable patient who had a PSA of 350 and that big external iliac lymph node that was biopsy proven.
And his PSA came rocketing down, I remember it very well.
Yeah. And remains undetectable today.
And that the two things I wanted to finish on, Michael, is one, of course, these studies are not possible without, you know, fantastic support from people. We should acknowledge those who enabled this study. You mentioned it was up from PSMA, but do you want to just remind us who supported the study?
Yeah, the primary funding came from Movember, which partnered with the Australian government. There's the thing in Australia called the Medical Research Future Fund that matched the Movember funding one for one. We pulled in E.J. Witten out at Epworth. A lot of these operations were done in the private sector, and you've led that sort of public-private collaboration, and I think it's fair to say that none of these trials would succeed without that. And then we have additional support, are lucky enough to have a nuclear reactor near Sydney run by ANSTO, an Australian government agency, and they provided the lutetium 177 to us. And, you know, we all need a bit more research support, and, you know, we're all supported by the US-based Prostate Cancer Foundation. We have Renew as a PCF young investigator. Price Jackson, who's our medical physicist on the trial, is also a PCF young investigator. And now also James Buteau just announced nuclear medicine PCF young investigator, and we really need all that support. So it was really a multi-pronged effort, and the amount of teamwork that's required to make this happen is really astounding. So really, it's a kudos to everyone on the team.
Yeah, and even our anatomical pathologist, Catherine Mitchell, who's done an amazing job looking at these specimens and giving us fresh tissue for our translational work. She's, you know, you know, I'm always going to remember the days when we take out these prostates and carry it straight up to the lab, to the cut-up room, and Catherine will give us a piece of tissue. It was really an incredible couple of years doing this trial.
And we tried to do some funky stuff at one point. We've got in one of the translational laboratories, there's a kind of beta emitter for histopathology slides that no one uses. And I thought, what about if I take a slide 6 weeks after surgery, there may still be some lutetium in there. And there won't be much. It'll be tiny, tiny doses. But unlike a human who has to stay still, we can image them for 5 or 10 minutes, I could just put this slide on the scanner overnight and let it scan for even 24 hours and recover some of that and see the actual activity in this pathology slide. So we actually did it. But we didn't get any good images. But we tried.
And on the dosimetry, because calculating dosimetry is fiddly in these small organs, aren't they? But Sheng Un, one of our radiologists, went and helped with the 3 time point imaging, corrected the partial voluming with MR rather than CT, because we had MRs on all these patients as well. And look, the last thing I want to do is talk about the patients, Renu, because, so 20 patients took part in this study. And I must say, and we know them all so well because it's a small group of patients, and they've been fantastic to be involved in this study. And during COVID, it was not easy. You know, extra visits to the hospital.
Yeah.
And thankfully, so many of them are doing very well. But as ever, when you're doing prospective research, having a group of patients who share your enthusiasm and trust us to ask a good question and look after them is what makes these things possible. So thank you to all the fantastic lutectomy patients.
And their families, yep.
Yeah. So Ken, final words, over to you. So we've got ourselves all excited about the future of it, and I hope we're here again in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years, perhaps talking about the NEPI study and other studies from your centre. I think a message out there to the urologists and radiation oncologists listening to this is, start talking again to your nuclear medicine physicians about what you can do together to ask more questions in PSMA imaging, but especially in theranostics.
So my last words is actually a big thank you to you, because first of all, thank you for this very pacemaking study, lutectomy, because I think it's going to help us design a lot of very innovative trials for the future. But also thank you for showing us how real multidisciplinary work is done in the field of GU oncology, because I think this again, and I mentioned this before, you guys serve as a role model to many sites worldwide, also to our site. So thank you very much for doing this. And also thank you very much for letting us be part of this.
And we look forward to welcoming Ken to Melbourne very soon, don't we, Michael?
Prostic 24. Prostic 24. It's coming soon.
Yes, theranostic preceptorship. It's going to be very good.
Yeah, we're flashing up some details of prostic, which is a fantastic preceptorship. You describe it. What is a preceptorship? It's really a deep dive into how to do PSMA theranostics.
It's really a teaching course intensive over 2 days. We cover PSMA PET CT and therapy, and a lot of interactive case discussion. So we're going to show cases all the way from easy to super complicated, really teach you how we do it. And it's not just screenshots, but we have live case reviews.
Fantastic.
Wonderful. Great. Well, that's about all we've got time for.
I think so.
We better draw a halt to it. So thanks very much to you, Ken, for joining us from San Diego today.
Thank you, Ken.
Yeah, great. Have a nice time over there. Thanks very much to Michael for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Here in the studio. Thank you to all of you for supporting GUCast. Thanks especially to the lutectomy team. We're flashing up the names of all of those involved in the manuscript here just at the moment. And we're going to sign out at the end with the late, great John Violet, our close colleague, who certainly helped inspire this study with some of the words that he had in the SIV. That's all we have time for in this episode of GUCast. As ever, please get in touch. Please subscribe. Please rate us. All that usual sort of stuff. We do love hearing from you, and we love to take your suggestions on board. Thank you very much, everybody, and goodbye.
So it's very exciting to be introducing this clinical trial at this point, which is exciting for many reasons, notwithstanding the fact that, as far as I'm aware, this is the first time that we've given this exciting treatment to men with non-metastatic prostate cancer in the world. Now, we know that surgery and radiotherapy are highly effective treatments for localized prostate cancer, and many men are cured. But removal of normal tissue or irradiation of normal tissue means that the treatments are associated with some acute and longer-term side effects. And also, not all men are cured, either due to failure of eradication of local disease or the presence of occult micrometastatic disease. Now, oncologists for more than 100 years have been searching for a magic bullet to treat prostate cancer, and I've been searching in my academic career for the last 20 years, and I have to say, lutetium PSMA comes as close to the perfect magic bullet that I've ever seen. We know from the metastatic studies that it works and is a highly effective treatment, and it's a highly effective treatment because we know it delivers very high doses of radiation. So in this study, we're going to assess, the primary goal of this study is to assess how lutetium PSMA can perform in the primary treatment setting before men have received any other treatment. And the way that we're going to assess this is primarily by looking at what radiation dose the treatment can deliver to the primary prostate tissue. And this will be supplemented by information from the radiological response. Patients will be scanned before they undergo their definitive surgery. And of course, we will have the surgical specimens at the end so that we can see what the radiation dose has achieved within the prostate. Now, there are many studies that may follow on from this. It may well be that lutetium PSMA is a useful adjunct to surgery or to radiation therapy, allowing us to cure more men than we currently cure with these approaches. But I also dream that maybe, we might find that lutetium PSMA is an adequate treatment alone and will put us all out of business and allow us to cure prostate cancer without the morbidity of the current approaches. So enough said, and I'll hand you over to the rest of the team.